Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and today on Sesquicentennial Stories is part two of my conversation with Dr. Lee Farrow, the author of Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase. I asked Dr. Farrow about some of the myths that she went into the project believing and what she learned along the way.
Yeah, so when I started
tell me about
research,
some of the women who have been inducted, about the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame,
to
go to alaskawomenshalloffame.org.
The phrase that everyone hears is Seward's Folly, and in fact, as I started doing research in this book, when I would tell anyone that I was writing about the Alaska Purchase, probably the only thing they knew was, you know, the phrase Seward's Folly and the fact that we paid $7.2 million for it. And so I also thought that was the case. And then when I actually started doing the research and reading more about it, I realized, no, that wasn't the case at all. In fact, there were some opponents within sort of the general public, at least as much as we know from the general about the general public's opinion based on newspaper sources. So there was some questioning in a few corners about, like, was it worth this much money? What were we buying? You know, it was remote. People didn't know that much about it. So there were some concerns about those kinds of things. But by and large, the public reaction was pretty supportive, especially in the West. In the California newspapers, there was a lot of support for the purchase. And the opposition came on Capitol Hill, where, you know, that's really not an unusual thing for politicians to fight and debate over big things like this. And so that's really where most of the opposition was. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, this was the same time that Congress was fighting with President Johnson, and things were still very tense after the Civil War. So it really shouldn't be a surprise at all that within Congress there might be debates about this, and those debates in, you know, many cases were fueled by other issues. But in the general public, people were more or less okay with the purchase.
The people who were against the purchase on Capitol Hill, wasn't some of that because it was sort of an enemy of Seward, so it was more personal than...
Yeah, I mean, in many cases, you know, it's pretty clear if you look at the people who voted against appropriation, for example, in the end, many of them were opponents of Seward and or Johnson. A huge number of the people who opposed the appropriation bill had voted in favor of impeachment only months earlier. So, you know, clearly there were other issues that played into their decisions about Alaska as well.
Hello. Okay. And any other myths that you went in thinking were one way and then you found out it was the other?
Well, there were a couple of myths that sort of emerged as I was doing the research, some things that I had not known that much about before, but I began to discover as I was doing the research. And that one of them is that the, you know, the purchase was this kind of like secretive deal that just came up overnight. Well, clearly, as we mentioned earlier, there actually had been a very long history of a discussion about this. Sure, the actual final product was done rather quickly. The treaty itself was done rather quickly, and there were only a few people involved in that decision before it was presented to the president and his cabinet. But in fact, there had been a conversation going on for a long time. So it's not like this was suddenly some kind of secret deal that somebody pulled out of their sleeve and it was rushed and hasty and ill thought out. That wasn't the case at all. And also, you know, neither party was scammed in this deal. Both parties knew what they were doing. Both Russia and the United States had a keen interest in this exchange of territory. Russia wanted to get rid of something that was difficult to oversee and difficult to protect and expensive. The United States, with its interest in manifest destiny, was, you know, eager to purchase that property, and also it had implications for trade in the East. So both parties gained from this. There's a perception out there in some quarters that somehow the United States tricked Russia, or, you know, it may be because of that speedy, quiet nature at the very end that somehow Russia didn't know what it was doing or got ripped off in some way. But that's not true at all. The other thing I discovered as I started doing the research is that there are people now who believe that somehow it wasn't a sale at all, that maybe it was some kind of lease, which is clearly not the case. I've also been confronted with people who have said that either we didn't pay for it or that the money didn't reach Russia somehow, and there's no evidence of that that I've found. And if the money didn't reach Russia, that would have to do with the Russian side, not our side anyway. There is a Treasury check that, you know, everyone has copies of that you can see that shows that we did actually pay for it. But yeah, there's some weird like stories that have come out as I've done this research, and some of them I'd heard before and some of them I hadn't.
You told the story about how you do readings and you're in Russia and how you are sometimes confronted by people who are...
Yeah, so it's been interesting since I've, you know, even before the book was published, I was in D.C. for an event and someone introduced me to a Russian person, and they introduced me as a person who was writing a book on the Alaska Purchase, and instantly, like, the first thing she said to me was, well, you know, that sale was not legitimate. And I was, you know, I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, the Soviet government canceled the sale. When the Bolsheviks took over in 1917, they canceled that sale. And I said, well, you can't do that. You know, you can't just say, like, oh, we don't count that anymore. It's, you know, we're going to do it over. But she was quite serious about it. And then when I was giving a presentation in January at the American Center in the American Embassy in Moscow, when I concluded my talk, an older Russian gentleman approached me and said that we had never paid for Alaska. And I said, well, that's not really correct. And he said, no, it is true. And so every day you should get up in the morning and you should say, thank you, Russia, for the gift of Alaska.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, a production of the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and I'm talking to Dr. Lee Farrow about the Alaska Purchase, and I asked her about Alaska Native life after the transfer.
You know, there is, as I mentioned, you know, there had been tensions before with the Russians present. Once the Americans came in, there were more tensions, at least for a period of time. So the person who was put in charge of Alaska after the U.S. purchase initially was a guy named Jefferson Davis, not the president of the Confederacy, but with the same name. And he was a military guy, and he was a general, and he was a bit of a bull in a china shop by most accounts. And he was the one who was helping to untangle the private versus Russian company property, and he was very forceful in pursuing American interests. And so under his leadership, there were some serious conflicts with Native Alaskans that resulted in some violence, actually. Subsequently, there were other people, observers and military folks, who came in and tried to create better relations with the Native there, but there continued to be some pretty serious tensions, and part of it was just cultural differences, and some of it was, you know, the United States trying to impose our government on these people who had been living on their own for a long time. The claims of a Native Alaskans would persist, actually, though, for decades. So when Alaska became a state, the question was raised again about Alaska Native claims to land, and this would not be settled until 1971, when the U.S. government finally settled it through an Alaska Native Claims Act, in which the claims of Alaska Natives were recognized by transferring land titles over to some regional and village corporations. So this question actually about, like, what place the Natives held in Alaska after the purchase and then all the way up through statehood actually was quite a serious one. And in the end, the Alaska Natives received, I forget exactly the exact number, it's over 40 million acres of land and millions of dollars in return for, you know, for the land that had been they had claimed was theirs through this whole period of time. I know that there are strong efforts this year, especially in all of these commemoration events, to make sure that the Native population perspective is taken into account, that the history of Alaska Natives is part of the conversation about Alaska in this particularly important year.
Finally, can you talk about the effect the Alaska Purchase had on the rest of the world?
So that's one of the things that was really interesting about the research that I did. I spent a lot of time in the National Archives looking at diplomatic correspondence between our State Department and our representatives in countries in Western Europe in 1867 to try and get a sense of what the other countries of Europe thought about this. And I also looked at newspapers from the period from various countries in Europe. And what I discovered is that although the United States was, you know, far away, an ocean away from Europe, and thus far we had not been involved in any kind of European events, really, people in Europe were quite alarmed by the purchase. They saw this as, first of all, they were worried that this meant like there was a real Russian-American alliance that was underway. So we'd been on good terms with Russia, and people knew that from previous events like the visit of the Russian fleet to the United States during the Civil War and our support or our sort of lack of intervention in the Crimean War. So, you know, people knew that Russia and the United States were on good terms, but now this seemed to really be a step in the direction of a genuine alliance. And that was very alarming to countries in Europe. They were worried that this would mean the United States perhaps would get more involved in European events. But even more so, they were worried that it meant that implicitly that the United States would back Russia in Russia's intentions in Western Europe, either just with like moral support, which could in and of itself have influence, or with actual, you know, the support of maybe the U.S. Navy. This is the time, you know, in the second half of the 19th century when we really see the problem of the Ottoman Empire rising. So, you know, the Ottoman Empire at this point had become known as the sick man of Europe. Everyone understood that the Ottoman Empire was growing weaker as various national groups, ethnic groups broke away, such as the Greeks and other groups, Serbs. And so there was a real concern that Russia was wanting to help dismantle the Ottoman Empire and that Russia would seize the opportunity to take territory whenever that did happen. And so there was a concern that if the United States was now an alliance of Russia, it could offer Russia support in that, that either the United States would sort of maybe say, hands up, you know, we're staying out of it, or the United States might actually offer physical assistance to Russia. So it actually was, surprisingly, quite an issue of conversation and concern in Europe during this period of time.
And there's still a really strong Alaska-Russia connection.
Funnily enough, this morning I got an email from St. Petersburg from someone who works in the consulate there who would like me to go and do a talk about this. And he said he's from Alaska and that, you know, people in Alaska are very interested in Russia and people in Russia have this strong sense of connection to Alaska. So although even among people who have just sort of, you know, standard views about the situation, they still feel that there's a connection there and a connection that's worth maintaining and emphasizing and celebrating.
Well, the book is Seward's Folly, A New Look at the Alaska Purchase. I've been talking to Lee Farrow. Lee, thank you so much for being a part of this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
This series is sponsored by the Sitka History Museum and the Sitka Historical Society with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCAW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.